Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams. Dr. Williams is the author of the acclaimed book, Shattered by the Darkness, Putting the Pieces Back Together After Child Abuse. Dr. Williams is on the senior leadership team at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas. And Dr. Williams travels the United States speaking and training professionals, parents, and victims about the importance of dealing with abuse and personal trauma head on and not being afraid to break the silence of your own personal pain. Feel free to call in to tonight's show at 888-627-6008 and speak with Dr. Williams and his guests live on air. And now, your host, Dr. Williams.
Welcome to Breaking the Silence. This is Greg Williams here in Houston, Texas, the most beautiful city in the world. And I am so excited about our guest this evening. And it's just going to be a wonderful time. We're going to have some wonderful input. And you're going to want to make sure you have your pencil and a piece of paper, because there's going to be a website or two. There's going to be some information that he provides, maybe even an email if you want to contact him directly. That you will want to write down, because this is absolutely awesome information that we're going to be getting into tonight. I want to let you know that our 800 number, 888 number, do not call in this evening, because we are pre-taping this because at this time on Sunday night, I will be in St. Louis, Missouri, holding my latest grandchild. So our guest today has agreed so graciously to pre-tape this, and I think in all the years I've done this, I've only done it a couple times, but I wanted to make sure I had our guest on and to provide this wonderful opportunity for you to hear the wisdom and the story and the life and the mission that he is on, and we're going to share him with you just in a few seconds. I tell you what, we had a great week this week. My latest book, When Dark Clouds Come, The Roadmap to Hope, the book for teenagers and the 20-year-olds came out this week, and the Kindle edition started on sale on Monday, and I believe we have hit over 50,000 Kindle books out already, and I haven't advertised yet. So if you want to get on Amazon and look that up, When Dark Clouds Come, and I appreciate you just looking at it. You don't have to buy it. Just look at it, because every time you look at it, somehow Amazon grades and keeps a tick of all those eyeballs that watch it, and then it pushes it up on the list and becomes more readily available for people to see. So thank you for everybody that supported that. August 16th, the actual hard copy of the book will be in all the Barnes & Nobles, Books A Millions, Walmarts, Targets, and Amazon to be able to buy, purchase, or whatever. But I'm excited about that. Thank you for supporting that. And with that thought in mind, I think it's awesome that we are focusing tonight's program on kids and on children and on education, because I truly believe that is so important right now. I was going to do a little prelude, but I'm just going to pass off, because if this is that important, I want to get straight to the guest. Kristen Love, one of my, I feel, dearest friends in my life, Joe Hendershot, contacted me this week, and he was in a, I think, a convention, and Tristan can tell you more about it, in Dallas. I have never met Joe except via Zoom and radio shows and telephone calls and things of that order, but I feel that he's one of my best friends. And when he recommends a guest and he said, Greg, you have to get this man on the show, I immediately said, absolutely, let's do it now. And we contacted Tristan. And Tristan Love is passionate. And I love people that are passionate about making schools a safe and supportive place to learn. And folks, lean into the computer right now. We need this more than ever in the history of our country. And this is so important. So they have a place of safety to learn, develop, grow, interact, and learn what the meaning of life is all about. And the passion that is rooted in Tristan's experience are at risk students, and has an experience in nurturing schools while he experienced several traumatic events in his own life. And we're going to talk about that also. So he has all these degrees, all this experience. He's been featured in Wall Street Journal and all of that. But I tell you what, let's get straight to Tristan and let's talk right to the man. Tristan Love, welcome to the program tonight.
Greg, thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here. Glad to be able to have this discussion and conversation with you today. This is amazing.
Well, fantastic. You look wonderful. You're in a little office environment there. I don't know if that's a back screen or not, but it's a good one. It looks good. Tell me, first of all, what were you and Joe doing up in Dallas? And was you causing shenanigans and tomfoolery, or what was going on up there?
Yeah, it was a mix, a healthy mix of shenanigans and tomfoolery and presentation, right? I had two sessions on Wednesday and Thursday that went very well, and the conference asked if I can do a third session. And basically, the third session was triple booked. So they booked this huge ballroom, but they triple booked the room. I got there first, like I was the first presenter to get there. And I'm thinking all these people are in this room for me. And I started finding out that the room was triple booked. And I started asking people what session they were there to attend. And a lot of those people said Joe's session. They wanted to learn about social and emotional learning. And so at that point, when I found out that there was people already in the room for Joe, when Joe finally arrived to the room and we were having discussions about whether, you know, I was going to be moved or Joe was going to be moved, I was like, Joe, and I don't know him. This is my first interaction with him. I just looked at him. I say, take the room, take the ballroom, and I'll go elsewhere. And, you know, basically he had a great session. I end up having a packed out session in a whole nother room. And afterwards, he came up to me. He was like, you know, that was a very classy act. And I appreciate you extending that courtesy to me to be able to allow me to have that room because you didn't have to do it. But I feel deeply that was the most right decision I could have made in that moment. And the people that were in that room was there for the SEL session. And, you know, like I saw him already starting to get set up and starting to get ready. And I was like, you can do that in that room. Like, let's go ahead and get started. And that's the kind of atmosphere I like to create where, you know, it's not like, you know, we're going against each other, but truly we're here to serve the same purpose. And, you know, however I can be able to like help in that situation, I just wanted to be of service.
Isn't it amazing how, and I believe this, and I'll find out if you do, these divine appointments aren't just happenstance. Mm-hmm. Isn't that great? Because I think, got a feeling you and Joe and me also, I think we'll be friends for a long time now and cross paths several times. And we all on this journey together because we all have the same passion. I love when that happens.
I love it too. And you know, for Joe to stop by the table and really, you know, start, like we had a conversation. He learned a little bit about my background, where I come from, why I do what I do. And the first thing he said, he was like, man, that's amazing. I got someone I think you should talk to. And he started texting you and you end up calling. And that's how this whole thing came to be. And so it's just amazing. And I got to learn about his background and the work he's done in schools, serving, you know, kids that are incarcerated, serving kids that are in alternative school placements. And, you know, when we talk about breaking the school to prison pipeline, that's the work, like, especially in education. That's the work. That's where we're in the trenches, really trying to make sure that we can help students and support students in a full, authentic and organic way to help them be able to break these cycles of negative generational cycles.
Wow. I'll tell you what, hats off to Joe. I'll do the hee-haw salute to Joe for bringing us all together. And I just love him. And I know he does wonderful presentations out doing them today, even. And we have to have him and his wife back on the program again. Maybe all together we'll have a great discussion. So tell me then, Tristan, about you. I've read all about you, and I've been on your website, and I have read every page, watched everything that could be watched, and I'm absolutely so excited that I really want to find out about you first and then what you're doing with Wayfinder.
And so a little bit about me, born and raised in Houston, Texas.
Awesome.
So inner city kid. So when you say the most beautiful city in the world, Greg, I'm a fan and I completely agree. Born in, you know, when I was born into a situation where I was a product of a side relationship. And so I was born into this world in a way that I probably shouldn't have come from most people's perspectives. And the result of that is, you know, it's severe isolation because neither parts of the family want anything to do with you. And I was born with this gift. I think it's a gift now, but initially I didn't think it was a gift. I was born with colored eyes, Greg. And I was born with like these hazel brown eyes that neither of my parents had, that only both of my grandparents had. And so when, you know, people saw me, they really saw like glimpses of both of my grandparents. So here I am, like, you know, basically not coming into this world in the best predicament. And then I come out looking like both my ancestors. And, you know, having to like navigate that world and that space was tough within itself. But I think the third thing is just having working class parents, parents that had to work. And we're talking about 10, 12 hours a day. My mom worked in schools, cafeteria lady. My dad, he put up, you know, climbed on these, you know, these ladders to put glass in. And so as my life played out, I found myself spending a lot of time by myself because I think about going to school. I went to school. I did what I needed to do. I can think as far back as elementary, I walked back home and I had to stay in the house by myself until my mom comes back home. I think about the days that she didn't want me to walk back home because maybe she was working a hospital job. She'll tell me, catch the bus. And Houston is a super big city. And yeah. So I think about myself in second grade, getting on the metro and, you know, going to my mama's job after school. I remember times when I even got lost on the bus and get lost on the bus at, you know, 8, 9 years old and wake up because I went to sleep on the bus and wake up and not know where you at and how I'm going to get back. And, you know, adults coming in to help me out. And so my early experiences in life put me in this severe state of isolation just because my mom went to church a lot. And, you know, we went to church, you know, 4 times out of the week. If it wasn't church, you was at home. If you wasn't at home, you was at school. And it was very, very structured in that sense. But some of the things like, you know, being able to, you know, have these deep, you know, friendships where I can go over my friend's house or I can go play and I have this, you know, freedom to be able to build this connection I wasn't able to do. And then I guess to mount all of this together is there became a part of my life where my mom, you know, basically was raising me by herself and she was raising a boy in inner city Houston. And so she made sure that, you know, her presence was felt. So I think about whoopings and beatings and all the things that come around with making sure that you know that, you know, if you do something wrong, there's a consequence that come with that. And, you know, I think, and so when I start framing what the early years of my life look like, it comes from that standpoint. I think all of this stuff really came to a head when I reached about 12. We moved into some low income housing apartments in central Houston, is Fourth Ward specifically. And during that time, I was fighting like no tomorrow. You know, I was this the new kid on the block, colored eyes, no siblings. I was here by myself, even though I have a blood brother. He wasn't staying with us. I had, you know, I was in this environment again, isolated, and I was fighting. Kids tried to pick on me. I was fighting, but luckily I had just moved from Fifth Ward, which was also a tough neighborhood that prepared me for living in Fourth Ward. So I can fight, I can tumble with the best of them, but they got to a point where I just got tired. And I was looking for ways to, like, how can I just live my life in a more peaceful fashion? And basically I joined the gang. And so I got jumped in. I did my, you know, did the tasks that were assigned to me in order to be a part of a gang. And I was a sixth grader. I was in a gang. I was going to church four times a week. But that time where I was out of school, that time where, you know, the time between school ends and my mom got home, and when my mom was getting home, was the time that I was getting into the most stuff. And, you know, that really shapes, like, my thought process as I start going into my high school years, because that time, especially that early isolation, I think about those whoopings. I think about, you know, having to fight, being picked on, trying to find my place in this world for, like, my family, and trying to find my place with, like, the wider world, like, in, you know, in, with friends in the community. It's something I still really struggle with, just to, like, be frank, but it's a way that I've, you know, I feel like there, those places have, like, guided my thinking on, like, how I navigate this world in a way that's purposeful and meaningful to me.
Before we take the first break, because we're getting up, that's awesome background. What did you learn the most that you're using right now, possibly, Tristan, with being in isolation and dealing with isolation and working through those emotions alone? Because I feel that. I've been there, done that, too. What do you think you learned that's made you who you are today because of so much time alone?
That's simple. I learned how to deal with myself. And so I look inward. I know how to look in the mirror. I know how to be in my head and in my thoughts. And if I need to get something right, I come to self first. I'm not I don't point a finger. The first person I blame is myself. And I'll find out how to self-correct before I blame the environment. And I think that really came from, I'm sorry if you're hearing this, I think that really came from spending so much time alone and having so much time to be intrinsic, to be in my head, to be in my thoughts. And now as an adult, to be in my head, to be in my thoughts, I really utilize that strategy a lot. And honestly, it works well for me, just because I'm able to really rationalize, be in real deep thought on how do I position myself, correct myself to be able to find, like, a place that I want to be in life. And I think it's a big part of, like, why I'm here today.
That's great. Is there any downside to that?
Yeah, it's a lot of first. Yeah, it's a lot of downside. It's a lot of downside to that. Yeah. I mean, like, that's the opposite side of the coin is sometimes I'm super hard on myself.
Yeah,
I'm hypercritical of myself. And, you know, and I think about how my mom used to get on me about the smallest things. And I even think about me as a parent. Like, how do I make sure I have to pause myself from being able to pass that on to my kids? Because of, like, you know, that it kind of flows. It was given to her and it was passed to me. And, like, I have to self-correct myself to make sure I'm not passing that off to my kids, being hypercritical, because in my mind, that's just how my brain is wired to, like, look at what's wrong.
Yeah, you gotta break the cycle.
What you're not, right. And so that's a task. And so when I think about trauma, it doesn't come without consequence. It's a great storyteller, but you know, you live with it. You have to go through those motions and know that it's there, and how you think about it and how you find solvency and how you can eventually break that cycle, stop doing that, or at least passing it on to someone else. That's a real drawback, and it's a tough part. about being super internal.
Fantastic. I tell you what, we're going to take our first break. I know now in just this first few minutes why Joe texted me so quickly. When he said, hey, I've just met this wonderful young man, you got to get, I know why now. Fantastic, Tristan. Tell you what, on the other side of this, the Wall Street Journal talked about you. I want to know why. And on the other side of this first commercial break, we're going to find out why and what you have done with what has happened to you in your youth through high school, and then what you do to be able to take that to children that may be experiencing it themselves right now, and what words of wisdom do you have to give them. Don't leave us. We'll be right back after this first commercial break. Don, roll the commercial, and we'll be right back. Hang with us.
HCI Publishing, that brought you the international bestsellers, A Child Called It, and the Chicken Soup for the Soul series, comes the latest book by Dr. Gregory Williams, Shattered by the Darkness. This book describes the horrific abuse that Dr. Williams suffered at the hands of his father for over 12 years, and the damaging effect of keeping everything silent about that abuse for 30 years. If you're looking for that book that you can't put down, then pick up a copy of Shattered by the Darkness by Dr. Gregory Williams at all Barnes & Noble stores, Amazon, and Books A Million. Now, back to Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams.
Welcome back. We have Tristan Love with us today, and it's just a wonderful first segment, and we're getting ready to find out more about his high school years and then college years. So when you experienced and started understanding that this was the role that you were in as a child, how did that start developing you into the paths that you were going to take, and then eventually the path that you're on right now with the organization that you're with?
Yeah. So I think the first thing I realized, it was, I was searching for belonging. I was searching for friendships, and I was searching for...
Did the gangs give you any of that belonging, Tristan?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah, for sure.
Is that amazing?
So I like to break belonging down into four concepts: acceptance, respect, inclusion, and support. And so when I think about belonging, I think about it's a space and a place where an individual is accepted, respected, included, and supported. And you get to bring your full authentic self to that space in order to receive the benefits. Like, you don't have to shape or shift who you are to receive that benefit. So I said that to say, when I think about being in a gang, it offered an unhealthy version of belonging. Mm-hmm. And in the sense where I was accepted, I was respected, I was included, but in order to do that, I had to deviate from every way my mom raised me. I had to deviate from every, you know, value I had. I basically essentially had to become another person to be able to survive in that context. And when you think about the belonging, if you have to turn into somebody else or shape or shift who you are to fit in, then you don't belong. And I didn't understand that concept, because belonging is such a desire that, you know, we would go through extraordinary lengths to feel it. And sometimes when we don't feel it holistically, we settle for these very small pieces of it. And when I think about my experience as a gang member, I was really just settling for this small piece of belonging because I wasn't experiencing it holistically. I don't know of a space during that time where I was just able to be my full authentic self, especially at 12, 13. And even in that space, I was accepted, respected, included, and supported. So that kind of framed my perspective of belonging and a gang. Like, yes, I experienced belonging, but it was an unhealthy version of belonging. Yeah. And a lot of our kids have a problem differentiating and discerning the difference between healthy belonging and unhealthy belonging. And I think that's a skill. When we talk a little bit more about like what I do now, that's a skill that we have to foster in kids, because with social media and all of the things they have access to, that belongingness is still there. And if they're not getting it at home, if they're not getting it at school, or if the belongingness they see and experience is a version of unhealthy belonging, they take that as truth and think that's what they should feel like. That's what it should look like when they go out into the world and look to experience and feel belongingness. And so I think that was a big part of, in hindsight, that was a huge part. I would say 90% of my reason to join a gang. I was isolated. I was by myself. And there was something, a fire in me that says, like, you need to, like, feel a part of something. You need to belong to something.
You know, I love when somebody experiences life events as a child, learn from the good or the bad side of those experiences, whatever abuse with me, with what's happened to you in your childhood, and then find a path that can lead to a place for you to have not just a job, but a life of changing kids' world by letting them know, hey, this is where I was. I experienced it. We have developed something so you don't have to. And if you are in this, how can we propel you to the next level higher? And I love when that happens. It's almost like you took all this negativity and turned it into positivity, and now you're changing kids' lives. Tell me about how all that process with you. I love it.
And so basically what happened is I went to my first high school in Houston in ninth grade. I was kicked out of that high school because at the end of the year, I started a gang fight. I stayed in the streets that summer because I ran away from home, and I experienced, you know, some of my closest friends dying, like, you know, by gun violence, by, you know, random, you know, acts that they were doing that were, you know, very risky. And basically during that time, I made a decision. I was like, look, I'm not going to stay in the streets because I don't want to end up dead. And so I said, hey, I'm going to go to the north side of Houston and stay with my dad. The gangs on the north side of Houston are very different from the gangs that are on the south side of Houston. And so when I went to stay with my dad, I went to the school in Houston that was known as, it was the first high school for Black people in Houston. It used to be called Colored High. It was located in Fourth Ward, which I was like, what? I just moved from Fourth Ward. But when the city relocated that school and renamed that school, they put it in Independent Heights, and they renamed that school Booker T. Washington.
Oh, yeah.
And I attended Booker T. Washington, and I thought that I was going to be able to go to this school with the same antics I used at the first high school I went to. And those teachers there, they didn't play. They wanted, you know, I had a teacher named Miss Solomon, and she was hard on me from the moment she met me. Like, I couldn't do nothing right in her eyes, but she said something that always resonated with me from the very first moment I met her. She said, you know, when I see you, I see a Kappa man. I see a Morehouse man. And I was like, what is this lady talking about? Like, I didn't know if she was trying to be disrespectful or she was saying something good. And so I ended up doing some research, and I found out Morehouse is a college.
Yes.
And people like Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. graduated from Morehouse College. I was like, oh, okay. And then when she was talking about Kappa, she was referring to a fraternity, because I always wore red because I was affiliated with the gang I was a part of. And so when she saw me wearing red, she didn't see me as a gang member. She saw me as a member of like this college fraternity, Kappa Alpha Psi. And so I went and started researching that. Like, what is that all about? And man, these distinguished guys, they dress well, scholarly, everything together. The girls love them. I'm like, this lady can't see all of this in me, but she did. And whenever I come into school, while other teachers, you know, and I'm a mess. Like I'm not clean cut. I don't have the best shoes. I don't have the best clothes. But every time she saw me, she's like, "Oh, there go my Morehouse man. Morehouse man, I need you to tuck in your shirt. Oh, Morehouse man, I'm gonna need you to start ironing that shirt when you come in there, because you know, my Kappa man, they like to make sure they looking real good. So I need you to start looking real." And so she started pouring into me in a way that the only other person that has done something like that was my mom. And so like she became like a motherly figure to me at school. And then during that same time, I started looking around the school and I thought like, maybe it's just her. Maybe she's just the one that's doing this, but every teacher in the school was doing this in some shape, form, or fashion to some kid. They were like pouring and investing into them. And really what I found out they wanted you to know is that you are good enough as you are. And every day you come into the school, you already have strengths. We're just going to help you use those strengths as resources. And that was a paradigm shift for me, because I'd never been into a place where I was able to be my authentic self. And then I was accepted, I was respected, and I was included. But my junior year, somebody broke into my dad's house. At the time, Greg, my dad is 67. So I got an old school father. My dad is 67. I'm in 11th grade. Somebody broke into his house. And remember, I told you, he has this hard labor job. 67, picking up these windows on his back. And he's doing this to help me graduate. And basically what he ends, you know, they broke into our house, took everything out of our house and set our house on fire while I was at school. And I had a feeling, and I mean, I don't know the entire truth to this day, but I still have a feeling that that was due to my affiliation, gang-wise, or one of the groups I was hanging out with that, you know, maybe got too close. We don't know. But I felt personally guilty, and I was like, you know what? I'm done with school. I'm going to drop out to help my dad so he doesn't have to continue this hard labor job. That school didn't let me, Greg. That school really wrapped their arms of support around me. They paired me with this organization in Houston called Communities in Schools that is like a dropout prevention group. They made sure I had everything, all the school supplies I needed. My teachers all pooled a pot of money together to make, and the teachers don't make a lot of money. And they pulled their pot of money together to make sure I can go buy clothes and shoes and things for the next day, so I can come back to school the next day. And then Communities in Schools even went to the extent of basically finding me a mentor, helping me find my mentor. And this is a woman named Pat Rosenberg, which, you know, at the time she sat on the board of Communities in Schools, and I met her at a conference Communities in Schools sent me to. And this woman just was being nosy, and she wanted to know about my story. She wanted to know about my experience at the conference. And eventually, you know, it was like Miss Solomon. I kind of started figuring out, like, she just wanted to make sure I'm good. And so I started opening up. And next thing I know, she was like, "Hey, would you mind come and tell that story in a room full of educators?" And I was like, "Yeah, I don't know why they would want to hear my story of like being a gang member, my house burned down. Like, it's all these bad things are happening to me." And, you know, evidently, basically, you know, that resonates with people, because I found out I was considered at risk. And now I was starting to get my life together. I was starting to do better in school. I was starting to, you know, do better in the community, being able to tutor people. Like, I was getting on track. And a long story short, Greg, is when the Wall Street Journal thing came out, it came out because Miss Pat's husband, Mr. David, he always writes to the Wall Street Journal. And Miss Pat has two daughters, and both of her daughters were off to college. And basically, she became my mentor. And the Wall Street Journal thought that was like super interesting, of this old white lady mentoring this young gang member, basically. Like, our worlds are totally different. But here we are, like two peas in a pod. Like, Miss Pat is my person, even now to my kids. She's Nana Pat. And they thought that was interesting. So they did a story or article on her on how to cure the empty nest syndrome, like basically what she did was she went back into the schools and she mentored me. And then they did an article, a video article on me, and they said ex-gang member gets accepted to Morehouse because I got accepted to Morehouse. And so here I am. And it gets better, Greg. Believe it or not, it gets better. Here I am, you know, boom, going through the stuff I'm going through. I get accepted to Morehouse and my life is on the up and up. My dad was smart enough to have house insurance, fire insurance on the house. He bought this house as a project house. We get a brand new house as a result of it. So that was a blessing in disguise. And then the last piece of this is, you know, I'm on the way to Morehouse. Like, I'm college bound. I graduate in the top 10% of my class. I clean it up real good. I never go to Morehouse, Greg. I never go to Morehouse because I was a football player. During the football season, I got hurt. So I wasn't able to play basketball. That was another key sport for me. So I end up going to a debate tournament to see my partner Shamara debate. And basically her debate partner didn't show up. And because her debate partner didn't show up, she looked at me and she was like, bro, could you be my debate partner? I was like, I'm just here to watch you. And really, I'm here because, you know, we get to skip this dual credit class at HCC to be here. And basically how this ends up playing, how it plays out is that Shamara was like, look, have you ever wanted to argue with your mom or, you know, somebody of your superior? I was like, yeah, all the time. But I know I'll get slapped to Timbuktu too. She was like, think about this. Think about you having an opportunity to talk back to a parent or somebody else and just negate every single thing they say. If they say left, you say right. If they say up, you say down. I was like, all right, cool. I got you. We went there and this was a state qualifier. We went there and placed second in the entire tournament. And so you had these prestigious schools like Carnegie, HSPVA, like all of these schools, Yates, all these schools that have very prestigious, well-established programs. And here Shamara and I just come just saying, nope, 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 nope. And on argumentation, we did a stellar job and we end up placing second in that tournament, which qualified us for state. And in Houston, that was a big deal. I didn't know. I'm like, man, I don't even know about this space. And I guess why I round this off is this was during the same time the movie Great Debaters came out with Denzel Washington and Nate Parker. And if you haven't saw the movie Great Debaters, it's about this old college team at Wiley College. It's in, you know, in like the early 1900s. And basically this team, this small historically black college, was the number one debate team in the nation. And so basically after the movie, Denzel was like, Wiley, why y'all don't have a debate team no more? And Wiley College was like, well, we don't have money for a debate team. And Denzel Washington was like, say less. I'm going to put together a committee and I'm going to donate $1 million. And I need y'all to go out and find me some debaters. So basically, at the end of July, I'm on my way to Morehouse. I get a call that says, hey, this is somebody from Denzel Washington's committee. I'm thinking this is a prank. They say, Wiley College want to offer you a full ride scholarship to come here and debate, and it's going to be paid for by Denzel Washington. And I'm like, you got to be kidding me. And it was like, nope, yes or no. And so that's how this stuff start just picking up speed. And my life goes from like this gang member who's trying to like find this sense of belonging and fit in, and to basically this person who's like just aligned. Like these divine interventions are happening in the way where, Greg, I can't make this stuff up. I can't even imagine. I can't even fathom the things that are happening. And I'm just like in the center of it all, just receiving it. And like, I didn't see that coming. And I go with the flow. I be obedient. I make sure the things, like, you know, I learned that when you're blessed, and when you're given favor and grace, you know, you guard that. You make sure that what you do in this world is continually exuberating, like putting that back out, putting that energy back out into the world. And I mean, that's been my mission ever since. Like, I've been blessed beyond belief, and there's no way you can't replicate it. And when I think about, you know, when we get to the part when I'm talking about working with kids, I remember what it felt like to be taught that sideways by a teacher. I remember when someone told me that I wouldn't be nothing. I remember when I was talked down to and I was counted out. I know what it feels like to walk into a classroom, into a school, and immediately feel small and undervalued. And I think those feelings paired with the type of things I witnessed at Booker T was the things that prepared me to be this educator that was able to like play both. Like, I know what it feels to support school students holistically, because I know the, you know, like what they're going through. But now I'm, you know, I'm educated. I got the, you know, the degree and knowledge and know-how and willpower to kind of merge these worlds. And I guess the missing piece was to actually go into a classroom and do it.
Wow. Tell you what, I see God's fingerprint all over this. This is absolutely fascinating. We're going to take our last commercial break. And on the other side of this, we got to find out now. After all of this is happening, you have been set up to do, I mean, absolutely ready to go, prepared to make an impact on kids. What have you done since and how you're doing it today? And I can't wait to find out, because I really want to dig in and drill into this curriculum that you're dealing with now. We'll be right back right after this last commercial break for the final segment of Breaking the Silence. Hang with us. You know, I tell you what, I have been working on this project for the last couple of years, and we keep promising you that this book was going to come out, but it is now out right now on Kindle edition. And I can't be more excited than I am about this book, because it's a perfect timing for what our teenagers, 20-year-olds, 30-year-olds, basically everybody needs. And it's called When the Dark Clouds Come, The Roadmap to Hope. It's available right now on Amazon, on Kindle. And to be available August 16th, actually on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Walmart, Target, Books A Million, and all those sites. And just a few topics that it talks about. Chapter one, you're going to find out how, where you are in life and how to find out how to get where you're going. Chapter eight tells you about how to take control back of your life. Chapter 11 deals with how you're dealing with anxiety and anger. Chapter 12 goes even deeper into depression. How do you deal with that? Hurt, pain, and suicide. And there's just so many things. I personally believe that every person that's listening to me, every parent, every grandparent, every school teacher, every doctor, every library, every church, every counselor, every minister needs a copy of this book and copies to hand out to the people that are going through some of their own storms of their life. When the Dark Clouds Come, The Roadmap to Hope. Get this one. I'm proud of this. And this is the one book that I wish I had when I was going through all of that abuse, when I was a child, when I was a teenager. I wish I had that to be able to turn, to be able to learn how to get through my storms to hope. Roadmap to Hope, When the Dark Clouds Come. Don't miss it. It's on Amazon right now. looking back, all I can say is wow. And I don't want to fluff anything else with extra words because I want to get right back into this. We only have about 10, 12 minutes left, and I really want to make sure I get into Tristan's side of this. And Tristan, I want to go ahead and ask, can you come back sometime in a future show? I need to find out more.
Yes,
for sure. I got to find out more about this because there's a lot of stuff that you skimmed over that it's like, oh, I like to stop, but I didn't want to stop you. So I want to make sure you and maybe Joe can come back together and we can just do a wonderful program. But thank you for being here. So now you're at the school. Denzel Washington's writing the checks to have you go through college, and you're out wanting to make a difference in other kids. Tell me how you do that, how you did that, and how you're doing it today.
Yeah. So after graduation, I became a teacher back in Houston ISD and at Sam Houston. And I taught biology. I was a biology major, a chemistry minor. I know, Greg. It's a biology major, a chemistry minor. I loved Bill Nye, the science guy. I had a lot of time to watch him. I'm teaching science, and I'm teaching it in a way that it resonates with kids who typically don't connect with science. I'm able to connect it to their world, their life. And then like my sheer energy for like what I'm doing is like contagious. And so they pick it up, and they pick it up to a extent where in terms of tests and assessment, they're showing 2 and 3 years worth of growth within one single school year. And any educator that's able to go into a very difficult school as Sam Houston was, it was 18 years underperforming, at risk of being taken over by the state. I mean, it enabled me to like move up very fast. And basically within 4 years, I was the assistant principal graduating the freshmen that I taught my first year. And so after that, a lot of that experience was grounded in my experiences. Like, how do we create a culture, a community? How do we holistically support students and make the climate effective for learning? And how do we make that climate safe? How do we make that climate supportive? And so we did that work, and that work ended up turning into me creating a school for the district, HISD. And basically, I supported 50 high schools in the district, and they sent me the kids that were kicked out of their campuses. And that within itself was another supportive place. I mean, any gang member that you can imagine Houston has, or any gang that Houston has, a student was representing that gang. And I had those students sitting in the same classroom with each other. And going off without a hitch, but because it was climate, it was culture. I made belongingness was readily available. You didn't have to do anything. No, I mean, just by being you, you were going to receive the benefits and this unconditional love, this unconditional support. Every teacher that you encounter was going to be on this page of being able to work alongside you. And so, and eventually I also became a principal. And so when I get into the work that I do now with Project Wayfinder, I basically work with schools all across the country from coast to coast. And I work with them on like, how can they use a curriculum and activity and activities to be able to create this environment for their school. And so what I really press on adults and teachers and educators and administrators that are running schools, the first thing, it starts with relationships. It starts with connection. We hear it a lot of times that kids don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. You have to be able to be in a position where your care and your love for what you do is transparent. And if it's not transparent, our kids have this keen sense to be able to differentiate who's real from who's fake. Who's out to be for me and who's out to be against me. Yeah. So a lot of my work is working with adults to say, hey, let's do a self-check. Let's check ourselves, because some of the meanest individuals I've ever experienced in schools were not kids. They were adults. And a lot of times we make up these toxic environments and say, but you should belong. Like, look at our mascot. You should be, you know, the stallion. You should be. But the kids don't feel a part of that because they immediately are feeling small. And so what schools are able to do with Project Wayfinder is they can look at their school structure and they can decide, hey, do we have a structure that supports us teaching a curriculum and teaching skills? Or do we have a structure that supports like teachers being able to use resources to be able to teach skills to kids, to be able to support this belongingness and purpose work? Because that's what Project Wayfinder is. Like, there's this big umbrella of social and emotional learning. Project Wayfinder is three things. The first thing is a belongingness development, like helping students develop their sense of belonging. And we can't give that to them. That's experiential. The second thing is this purpose work. Like, we want, as kids graduate from school, to have a clear direction, maybe not a point, but a direction in the things that are like meaningful to them, and they can go throughout life and function in that life with a deep conviction in the direction they should be going with their life. And the last thing are these things we call durable skills or future ready skills. And Greg, the big paradigm shift in education is that skills are not soft or hard, they're durable or perishable. Like, what are the durable skills that kids can have that will extend even after they get out of school? Because what we know is our world is rapidly changing. The world that's here today is probably not going to be the world our kids are experiencing once they graduate. So what are we doing in schools to prepare students for this world that's super uncertain? Like, what skills can kids have that can prepare them and be highly transferable no matter what the world looks like after they graduate? And so basically, schools use Project Wayfinder to be able to help build these skills, help build belongingness in the school, in the classroom, in the culture of the school, in the culture of the classroom. But also, as students start to matriculate through our school, like, how do we make sure they're going off into this world with a deep conviction in like what they want to do in this world and how they want to contribute to this world, and with a deep sense of purpose? And I think that's an accurate conversation for schools.
Is this curriculum adding, you know, because it seems like the schools where I grew up, IQ, 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 that's all they worried about. You got to learn this information. Mm-hmm. There was no EQ involved, emotional,
right,
at all. Mm-hmm. Is this curriculum combining and creating such a EQ piece that majority of schools are missing? Yes. And does it add to the curriculum that they're currently using, or does it replace the curriculum that they're currently using?
So the most effective way to use anything like this is to infuse it in what we do. It can't be like this thing over there and we teach science over here. It has to be infused. So as I'm teaching science, I'm also doing things in my science class that's going to infuse collaboration. And like, but that's a science teacher don't know what type of activities all the time to like pull from to be able to foster collaboration within their lesson. Or these are some activities I'm gonna do to foster fortitude. And like, what type of things I can do in my class to foster this sense of fortitude in the midst of my lesson? And the second question is about like whether it's replacing it or not. Yes. Greg, when I was a principal, I used a curriculum that was still on VHS tapes. And so, you know, I had to pay a teacher to be able to transcribe this curriculum to something that was more useful for kids and teachers. But yes, what's currently in place is either like super touchy-feely, and a lot of our kids don't want to go there. Like, I don't want to tell you all of my inner workings inside of me in school. And teachers don't want to do that either, because they'll tell you in a minute, like, I'm not a counselor.
Right.
But what teachers do want to do is they want to build skills in kids and be able to connect with them in a meaningful way. And through our curriculum, it really brings that to life. Like, how can we connect with kids in a meaningful way and to build skills that can enable them to be able to be, you know, to be prepared for wherever life they'll live in the future?
That's fantastic. Now, before we get to where they're going to cut me off and go to the next show, how can people find out more about you and this project and this Wayfinder? What's the best ways? I want to get that out now. We'll let you do it one more time if we have a chance at the end. How can they get in contact with all this information?
The best way is to email me at Tristan@projectwayfinder.com. You can send me an email. You can even go to our website. Our website is withwayfinder.com, and you can learn about Project Wayfinder and all the things that Project Wayfinder has to offer. If you want to connect with me personally, you can follow me. My handle on Instagram and Twitter is MrLove1911 on both platforms. I would love to continue the conversation there as well.
That's fantastic. And hopefully we'll have a chance. If not, we'll let the BBS radio put it in, possibly to where it shows up on the screen. That'd be awesome in this rant Sunday night. We only have a minute or two. What do you think right now, Tristan, is the most important thing that our children need to hear? Here I have this teenage book that just came out last week. And it's not saying, or this week, I'm not saying that the book is so good that it's selling so many, but there's a message that people are looking for and they can't find it anywhere else. What's the most important thing the kids need to hear right now with what our world's going through right now in the last minute or so? What would you say to that question?
The most important thing that kids need to hear is very simple. You are good enough as you are. You don't have to be another person in the midst of so many influencers and social media and challenges. You are good enough as you are. And we as the adults are going to make sure we create the environment where you feel a sense of belongingness, you feel respect, accepted, included and supported, and you get to be your full authentic selves. And you, every day you walk into a space, you already come with resources, you already come with strengths. Us as adults, it's our job to teach you how to use those strengths as resources. And that's what I would say to young kids.
That's fantastic. Tristan, I tell you what, I cannot thank you enough for being on the program this evening. And I can't thank Joe enough for recommending you. And I'm so glad that we divinely got all connected. And we didn't even talk about the importance of faith, but I got a feeling the faith's important to you. Talk about that next time around. But thank you so much for sharing your time. Thank you so much for making an impact. And thank you so much for Denzel Washington. Sure. I don't know if you get to meet Denzel or he calls you, you get to talk to him or anything, but we'll talk about that next program too. Lots of questions I have for you. But thank you so much for your time, your energy, and the way you're changing the world today. Thank you, Tristan.
Thank you, Greg. Thank Appreciate you for inviting me on the show.
It was my pleasure, my honor. As we do every week at this time when we close out a show, I always want to end up with saying, no matter what you've gone through, no matter what's happening to you right now, no matter what situation you're in, and we found this out with Tristan, his last little point there is so important. You are good enough. You have it all inside of you. Feel free to reach down and grab some hope, because hope is still there. Grab somebody's hand and help them along the way. And don't be afraid to reach out and grab somebody's hand when you need a little help on your path. That's what it's all about. That's what this journey of life is about. And I always want to let you know there's hope. Hang in there. Thank you so much for joining us this week. We'll have Tristan back shortly in the next few weeks. I promise you that. And we'll talk to you next week for another edition, live from the most beautiful city in the world, Houston, Texas, for another edition of Breaking the Silence. God bless. Have an awesome week. Good night.
Thank you for listening to Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams. To contact Dr. Williams, dial 832-396-6525 or email him at shatteredbythedarkness@gmail.com. And don't forget to join us each Sunday night at 8 p.m. Central Time, 6 p.m. Pacific on BBS Radio Station 1, for the next episode of Breaking the Silence.